Blog Talk Radio.
I lift up the jeweled breast. I lift up the amber lips. I lift up the shadowed eyes. I lift up
across the blue marble we call Mother Earth, and welcome. It's sure chilly here in Southern California where I am, so if I'm cold, I know most of you out there must be cold too, whether you are in my yesterday, today, or tomorrow. So wherever you are, grab that cup of tea and sit back and relax by the fire, and I thank you for tuning in once again to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition, especially during this Four Mothers and Wayshower series. I'm Karen Tate, your host, and that music comes from a group whose stuff I really enjoy, and I thank them for letting me use it here on the show, called Zingaya. If you tuned in last week, you know I'm experimenting with the format of the show. I'm now moving that well-liked and sometimes controversial What's the Buzz segment to the end of the show, so our guests don't have to wait through that to chat. So later, at the bottom of the hour, we'll be covering the following items in What's the Buzz, where we discuss the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week. We'll be talking about this article out there in the New York Times, The Evolution of the God Gene. It's about the origins of religion and religious behavior, or the evolution of religion from hunter-gatherer days to contemporary times, and whether that evolution might be some sort of detente between religion and science. I'll share some food for thought on the four waves of feminism and freedom from the prison of gender roles. And we'll have some important announcements about the latest developments on where abortion is fitting into the current debate on health care, and pagans who are taking part in the Parliament of World Religions in Australia this week. So you'll want to be sure to stay tuned, I hope, while those bees vent their relief later in the show, and I'll invite you to call in to those items that I was just talking about. The call-in number to talk to me during What's the Buzz is 718-766-4662. But I don't want to keep our current foremother waiting too much longer. Tonight we have as our guest Charlene Spretnak, and we're going to be discussing the Virgin Mary and the Dark Madonna Guadalupe because our feast day is Saturday. So to sort of set the tone for our chat with Charlene, let me share with you something beautifully written by Tal Malachi from the internet site that I enjoy going to often, called Sophian.org, about the Black Madonna or Black Goddess. Tal Malachi says, "When I gaze upon the Black Madonna, whether in her form as Our Lady of Guadalupe in the Americas or her European forms, I behold the countenance of mystery, things hidden, deep wisdom, and dynamic power. I behold a magical presence that answers prayers and invocations, extends blessings and grace, heals the sick, and works miracles when all hope is lost. I behold she who appears to all who seek her, whether saint or sinner, and she who reveals what is hidden. And though embodying an incredible destructive force, I behold in her the liberative power of the Divine Mother that draws souls up in the great ascension and the divine rapture. Her images appear in caves, grottos, and crypts, at crossroads and wells and on mountaintops, in the clefts of rocks and trees, and in all manner of places one feels something of the mystery of the womb and tomb, or one senses the threshold between this world and the world of spirits, the underworld or other side. If the bright forms of the Virgin Mary correspond to the full moon, then the Black Madonna is the dark phase of the moon cycle, the new moon that purifies, heals, and renews, and that initiates the power of the mystical death and rebirth through which the soul comes into being and is empowered in the divine life. In her, there is wild gnosis or crazy wisdom, divine passion and divine madness, the spiritual ecstasy that dispels the unreal and brings us into conscious union with the real, the truth of bornless being. She may be dread and terrible to those who do not know her and may turn one's world upside down when she's embraced, yet she is a most sweet and nurturing presence of the Divine Mother, enlightening and liberating the soul from bondage to sorrow and suffering. She is Mother Enigma, Mistress of Mystery. To know her is an adventure into unknowing and uncertainty, the wildness of life through which the most radical evolution takes place. There is no explaining her, but all who are willing can enter into the experience of her, and ready or not, at the end of days, all enter her embrace, for she is the end of days. There's more to it than that, but those are some of the highlights. So nice. I really, really enjoyed that. So Charlene Spretnak is our foremother tonight, and just in case you're not familiar with her work, let me tell you a little bit about all her credentials before we start our chat. Charlene is one of the founding mothers of the women's spirituality movement. Her first book in 78 was Lost Goddesses of Early Greece, which presented the research and the reconstructed myths of the pre-Olympian, that's pre-Zeus, mythology of Greece, which was almost entirely goddess-centered and had not been told for some 2,500 years. Her anthology, The Politics of Women's Spirituality, that was written in 82, presents a framework for understanding the emerging women's spirituality movement by presenting essays in three areas. First, recovering the lost history. Second, personal spiritual development. And finally, engaged social change work. In the 80s, Charlene wrote two influential books on green politics and was a co-founder of the Green Party movement in the United States. She also wrote States of Grace in 1991, which includes a chapter on the implications of contemporary goddess-oriented spirituality. She then continued her work in ecological thought with the resurgence of the real in 1997. More recently, she turned her attention to the fate of the Virgin Mary in the Catholic Church since the great modernizing conference, Vatican II. The result was her book, Missing Mary, which was published in 2004, which we'll talk about tonight. Charlene Spretnak is a professor in the Women's Spirituality branch of the Philosophy and Religion Department at the California Institute of Integral Studies, a graduate institute in San Francisco. She lives in Ojai, California with her husband. Well, Charlene, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure to have you on the show tonight. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. And let's talk about Guadalupe first, if you'd like, since her feast day is Saturday. Guadalupe, she's connected to the Tononzin. Did you want to maybe talk about that a little bit?
Well, her story is syncretic, as are all the Black Madonna stories in Europe. It's a matter of the indigenous sacred feminine presence and totemic animals and geographic locations merging with the Virgin Mary. So in the case of Mexico, the account of Juan Diego, who was a Mexican man who had recently converted to Christianity, he was crossing by the foot of Tepeyac Hill, the mountain or small mountain hill, which had been a site associated with Tononzin. So that's where he has the visitation of the lady, the luminous lady. He hears the bird song first on December 9th. He wouldn't be hearing birds at that time of the year normally, and he goes up to the top of the hill and sees this vision, and she reappears to him over 4 days. That's why, even though, as you say, the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe is Saturday, we're really in the story right now.
Okay.
So it's very much a merger, and it takes probably too long to tell the whole story, but she says to him, I'd like you to go into Mexico City and present-day Mexico City, and tell the bishop I want a church built here on this hilltop. And so he goes the first time, and he's sort of given the bum's rush as, you know, being a peasant, and goes back again, twice, and again is turned away. And finally then he is drawn to the top of the hill. He's actually trying to avoid her because his uncle's sick and he's trying to get to him. But he hears this, he's drawn to the top of the hill and smells the roses, these Castilian roses, blooming in December in Mexico. And he has a visitation of Our Lady, now known as Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she tells him, pick these roses and bundle them up in your cloak and go to the bishop and show him the roses so he'll see that there's something special going on and he needs to listen to you. So he goes to the palace, and this time he's admitted, and the viceroy happens to be there and all these other big officials having this meeting with the bishop. And so Juan Diego does as she told him to do. He unties the back of his tilma, which is a cloak made of cactus fiber. And as he unties it, the roses fall down onto the tile floor in front of him. And the bishop and the viceroy of Mexico and all the big honchos drop down on their knees with their eyes wide, staring at the tilma, which is still tied behind his neck, this big cloak. It's not only the Castilian roses in December, but on the tilma is the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is still in Mexico City. It's in a frame in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so that image of the big conquistadors kneeling before La Morenita, the little brown-skinned woman, is the foundational image of the Mexican Catholic Church. So it's very much a story of, you know, the old world and the new, and the indigenous tradition and the new. And Mary, who's in the Christian tradition not divine, she's more than human but less than divine, at least in the traditional Catholic understanding, merges everywhere with these indigenous manifestations of the sacred feminine.
Well, you know, Charlene, let me ask you a question that has always sort of perplexed me. Whenever we've had these apparitions all around the world, and we've had a lot of these Marian apparitions, you know, they're always Our Lady, or they don't really have a name, and people sort of just automatically assume, I believe, that they're the Virgin Mary. What would you say to that? I mean, of course, you know, how would you identify who these apparitions are that, or that, you know, sometimes appear to people?
Well, it's a very interesting subject. There have been more than 1,000 reported visitations, and mostly the church just leaves them alone. It doesn't prove them or disprove them. But of the ones that were recognized as the major modern visitations, Lourdes and Fatima and, you know, beginning in 1820 and then up through 1917, it's very interesting that she appears only to girls or to a small group that's half girls. And it was usually country people or uneducated people in the case of Visitation of the Immaculate Conception. It was a girl who went into Paris to become a nun, but she was from a poor family. So, yeah, I don't know. The identification of her with Mary sometimes is very clear, and then, as you say, sometimes it's not. It's the lady, the luminous lady, you know. But I think the way to think about the visitations is that some spiritual experience is occurring between those young people, in those young people, and then they face the question that all humans do when they have a spiritual experience. It doesn't really translate into our language system, especially our Indo-European language system, with everything focused not on process and states of beings, but on things and categories. It's a nominalized language family. So they can't really talk about what happened, as no one can. And then, because they're children, they're talking to adults, and the adults start filtering it through what they're hearing. And then, say, the parents go to the village priest, and it gets filtered again, and then to the bishop. So all these layers are put on what the authentic spiritual experience was, which I think always has to be honored as a mystery that doesn't translate.
Well, and if I remember right, the Guadalupe's appearance, she was speaking to him in his native language.
That's right.
So you had, you know, that filter again, you know, of trying to... It's hard enough to language a supernatural experience, and then when you have languages that don't have similar meanings, it just makes it that much more complicated, as you've said.
That's right. And, you know, she spoke, "I come from the great God." I mean, there were certain metaphors that would be familiar, you know. It was definitely a bridge experience between two orientations and two cultures, with all kinds of references that would work in both systems.
And then we know, too, if you're talking to people who are Christian, then they then filter it through a Christian lens, like so many ethnographers have done, in past cultures or when they're transcribing ancient texts. So, you know, to really get at the original meaning, probably most of the time it's really lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It has to be, I think, just, you know, held in that place and not felt that we have to nail it down.
Nail it down, exactly, yeah. People have often said, you know, you feel goddess, you don't think goddess. And I think that's what we're saying here. It's almost like you know it intuitively, you feel it, and, you know, those little details aren't quite so important, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
One last question about Dark Madonnas before we start focusing on Mary, which is, where most of our questions are going to lie. Did you want to mention some of the other Dark Madonnas that, for our listeners?
Well, I think the main point I'd like to make is that every Catholic country in Europe and Catholic region of countries that are half Catholic and half Protestant has a national shrine. And there's a Marian statue in the National Shrine, and it's always a Black Madonna in every country in Europe. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they have, all of them, different explanations for why the Madonna is black in their National Shrine. But it seems definitely connected with the earlier times. Some of them are gray or just earth-colored, and some are black. But it's not marginal in European Catholicism. It's right in the National Shrine. So I thought that was fascinating when I started my research, because I had not really realized that.
Well, is the Church still trying to pass that idea that it's candle soot, or have they given up on that?
Oh, yeah. No, I still see that once in a while. Oh, yeah, it's just candle soot. And then they clean it, and it's clearly not, you know.
Well, and what's so funny is...
It's Pindari, they cleaned that, and not only was it not candle soot causing her to be black, but she had coal rimming her eyes and gold flecks in her hair. you know, very much an influence of the Near East coming across the Mediterranean.
Well, and what's so silly about the candle soot theory, too, is interesting that it only affects the skin and not the clothes. It's like, you know, this candle soot selectively just landed on the body parts.
Right. Well, it's very interesting because in Europe, in Italy, in southern Italy especially, there are shrines, country shrines to the Black Madonna that are on sites that were Neolithic excavation sites. You know, the cultural historian Lucia Birnbaum has written a book which shows how it's really, as it was throughout Europe, a matter of the Christian forms being built or placed on the sites that were already perceived to be holy in the earlier religion.
Well, and we know there were even at least one Black Madonna that I know of, I think, in France, that when some of the paint was removed, it was actually Isis underneath.
That was very common because in the countries that were occupied by the Roman Empire, the Isis statues were so common. So that was a form, and they would just, you know, change that iconography a little bit or rechristen it as, you know, Mary, Mother of Jesus.
So how would you, you know, if someone said to you, okay, so why are the Black Madonnas or the dark Madonnas different than just the Madonna? How do you explain that?
Again, it's very localized because that Black Madonna in the National Shrine in every European country really holds the deepest roots of the cultural identification of the people. And so we have to honor the fact that they would probably all have slightly different responses to that question.
Well, do you...
Why is it different from the white? I mean, there are places, again, in Italy that Professor Chiavola Birnbaum has uncovered where there's one town, I can't remember the name of it, but on Palm Sunday, or maybe it's Pentecost, they have these processions, and one group marches behind a white Madonna statue taken out of the church, and the other marches behind a Black Madonna statue taken out of a shrine, and they meet on this soccer field and have a big soccer game between the white and the dark Madonnas. They feel that the Black Madonna is more, in Italy and Spain, the anti-clerical feeling is very strong, and so they feel she's more of the people,
uh-huh.
Whereas the white statues are inside the church system. It's looked at that way.
I see. Well, I know there are a lot of people who sort of connect the Black Madonnas a little bit more closely to Goddess. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, certainly in the ones that you can see were just renamed forms of the Isis statue, that's clear. And as
so her darkness being associated with nature and maybe the chthonic deities and, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. But it's not only the color of the statue. I mean, a lot of attributes, you know, birds that are pictured with her or different characteristics in these national versions of Mary came from pre-Christian goddess associations. And so it brings a continuity forward into this era, you know.
It's like the goddess is passing her baton on to the Madonnas.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, she doesn't live in this era until the whole reemergence of goddess spirituality in the 70s and beyond. But she doesn't, and really... Well, and in India, of course, she never died, and in the East. But in Europe, the modern era, there's not a goddess presence in it. But Mary comes into it in the way that made it possible for these attributes to go forward. And in the Christian story, she's what I call more than...
Oop, I apologize. Okay, go ahead.
In the Christian story, Mary is more than human, but less than divine.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a goddess. She starts out as a village girl, a Jewish village girl, and she goes on to become Queen of Heaven.
Right.
And it's really a story that can be understood on all kinds of levels, you know, that everyone has these cosmological possibilities to grow into your large self. I mean, you have the, you know, small self and the large cosmological self. And so she has cosmological dimensions and symbolic and mystical. But she's always in that special ontological category that only has one person in it. That's her, which is that more than human but less than divine. I think it's really a fascinating spiritual figure. And the thing is, I would like to say about her biblical story, because some people would answer the question you asked by drawing a line. Well, okay, you've got all that folk Catholicism stuff where the goddess attributes are put onto the Mary statues. But if you just stick to the Bible, just stick to the text and scripture, then you get away from all that and you'll just have the true, pure story. And that definitely doesn't work, folks.
Well, no, well, that's so
warped. There's so many attributes in her biblical story that link her to the older goddess tradition. You know, for instance, I mean, she produces a child parthenogenetically.
Which the goddesses have all done.
Yeah, without benefit of sexual intercourse, which was, you know, all the virgin goddesses, Isis, Hathor, Inanna, Ishtar, Demeter, Kybele, like Mary, produce a child without benefit of sexual intercourse. And it's often a male child. Hers is born at the coming of the light. They often become a powerful leader. And then they often die and are reborn. Oh, they're often born in a hidden place, like the stable that was carved into the hillside where Jesus was born. So her biblical story, not just the folk Catholicism, her biblical story has so many elements that link her to this continuity of the goddess spirituality flowing into what's going to come next in the next era in the West.
Well, speaking of the Virgin Mary and how she's viewed today, in the three branches of Christianity, the Protestants, the Roman Catholics, and the Eastern Orthodox, how is she, I mean, they all look at her differently, right?
Yeah, very much. Although two of them have branches have moved closer, I'll get to that. But, you know, traditionally, of course, Martin Luther, although he started out honoring the Virgin Mary, when he gets about 10 years into the Reformation, he makes the famous Christmas sermon of, I think it was around 1530, and that's where he really says, look, every birth has to have a mother, but no attention should be paid to her. It's not important. It was like a rent-a-womb. And if you were to honor Mary, you would be taking honor away from God. Because that's the gist of his whole theology. It's like a zero-sum theology where all glory to God. That's why when people would say to him later, oh, thank you so much for leading the Reformation. You reformed the church. It was so wonderful. And his famous answer was, God reformed the church. I just drank Wittenberg beer. So, again, no honor to anyone or person, including Mary, because that's an insult to God, the way his theology saw it. So, in the Protestant tradition, you know, Mary's not talked about except at Christmas time, and that's about it. And it really was a big dividing line and was very traumatic for European culture because, as I said, she was the great mother who was the also cultural heart of their identity as a people. So that break was made, and then traditionally the Roman Catholics honored the biblical description, but they also honored what I call the biblical plus, which is her whole symbolic, mystical, cosmological dimension. And that was beautifully expressed in so much fantastic art through the centuries and prayers, and you know, she was this large spiritual presence. And that's also the way the third branch, the Orthodox, or the Eastern Orthodox, view her. They very much honor the mystical dimension of her spiritual presence as the Mother of God. But they disagree with the Catholic Church in saying, you don't need all those doctrines and dogmas about her. It's really best to leave your spiritual communion with her in a realm that isn't so legalistic. So they disagree with all those, as they say, doctrines that the Catholic Church would put out about her. Now, let me go back to the second branch, because things changed radically within the Catholic Church regarding Mary at their big modernizing conference, 1962 to 1965, the Second Vatican Council, known as Vatican II. They decided it was time to be more acceptable to the modern world, to get more rational so they could get more respect from the modern world. And the rational text-based sort of anti-aesthetic version of Christianity was already established. It was Protestantism. And so they just moved in that direction. And they really threw Mary out the window, what I call Big Mary. Mary with a symbolic and mystical and cosmological dimension was just never to be mentioned again. I mean, it was the most radical break you could imagine.
Well, was...
let me just say, it's very politicized inside the Catholic Church now, especially the American Catholic Church, in a left-right axis, which is, I feel, very tragic.
And when you say left-right, you mean conservative and liberal?
Yeah, because the right-wing Catholics claim Mary as their sort of patron saint of all their right-wing political and social positions, and the left, progressive left half of the American Catholic Church agreed with that appropriation, went along with it and said, oh, yes, you're right. You know, whenever we see Mary, that means it's a right-wing group, which is not at all what goes on in the rest of the world. I mean, you may remember the whole independence movement to get rid of the dictator Marcos in the Philippines, and all the people in the streets marching toward the tanks, holding the statue of the Virgin Mary in front of them. Throughout Latin America, so many places where there are social change movements, Mary is their patron. Mary is of the people, and they feel she's helping them. But in the United States, that whole association has been just given over to the right-wing Catholics. So the progressive Catholics don't want to mention Mary much at all. And if they do, it's in a very literal historical way. So all kinds of books have been written by my progressive feminist sisters in the Catholic Church about the historical Mary, how big her house probably was, what the dimension of her kitchen probably was, how the neighbors were. I mean, it's amazing to me. I can hardly recognize it as a religion. It looks like anthropology to me or something. But they, you know, just that literal, historical, rational way to engage with her, and she's not queen of anything, for heaven's sakes, as they would say. And the reason a lot of the feminists in the progressive half of the Catholic Church feel that way is they say, well, we had to knock her off that throne because she was detracting from the effort to get the Catholic Church to recognize God as being as much female as male. For us to win this battle of getting the Catholic Church to recognize God the Mother, we had to sort of off Mary, who was draining some of that energy. So I don't
throw her under the bus.
That analysis, I don't think it's that kind of a competition, because Mary's more than human but less than divine. So it was a different thing. But that's how they see it.
Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, quite frankly. I'm curious about the left just sort of, giving in and going along with it. I'm wondering, I know the women in San Francisco at the Feminist Lutheran Church, her church. Those sorts of progressive, Christian churches, where do they fit into this? I mean, are they very much in the minority, or?
Yeah, that's a very unusual church, and it's a wonderful. But most of the progressive, feminist, Catholic theologians, I don't quite understand why, but they feel that the best way forward was to take this rational, historical version of Mary. That's why they were happy to let the Queen of Heaven stuff go over the right wing, because they wanted to be known as very rational, very good theologians, very text-based, and that's where they want to be known and place themselves. And so if you're going to play in that arena, of course, it's going to be just by citing biblical texts and not talking about all her spiritual dimensions.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, in talking about the Virgin Mary's lineage as a manifestation of the sacred feminine, I mean, I know, like, for instance, in Ephesus, Turkey, the Artemis just basically passed all her attributes on to the Virgin Mary. I assume that was pretty common. I mean, the Virgin Mary has a lot of Isis's attributes, too. And
Ephesus. In that place that used to be the temple to Ephesus, Artemis and Diana in Ephesus, and then became the church and the place where the bishops had their famous conference of where they declared Mary to officially be the God-bearer or Mother of God. So it was on that site. And when they took the vote and made this announcement, the people in the streets around the conference were cheering because they already viewed Mary as the Mother of God.
You're talking about the Council of Nicaea, right?
No.
Council of
Ephesus.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Council of Ephesus is where she was declared. And one of the things I learned in my research is every time the church made another declaration, doctrine, or piece of dogma about Mary that was more and more acknowledging her, what I call Big Mary characteristics, the mystical, the cosmological, it was always pushed by the people. It always came first from the people, and then the brass would come up with some rationalization to make it a new official doctrine of the church. All through history, that's the way it went. So I thought that was fascinating. And for instance, in the mid-19th century, when the Pope declared Mary the Immaculate Conception, there'd been millions of letters petitioning for that to happen from the grassroots.
Well, and I mean, I know this is anecdotal, but I mean, I grew up a Catholic, and my grandmother had statues of Mary in the yard and in the house, and you just hear about how the people, the people at the grassroots, they don't care about the church dogma. I mean, she's God, they don't care what the church wants to put in their little rule book.
Right. But I mean, that was very much true in the time when you and I grew up, but it's not true for young people now, because they grow up Catholic, and it's not very different regarding Mary as to being raised Protestant. She's not talked about. She's a nice lady in the Bible that, you get out her little statue in the manger creche scene once a year at Christmas, and that's that.
And this is all about having to put the emphasis on God. That's why she's diminished.
Well,
that
it's all about being a more rational modern religion and not having this giant goddess figure in the middle of the religion anymore.
Well, if you can have a giant god figure, why not a giant goddess? I mean, you know, sorry, but, you know, I guess that would be my question. You know, how would they answer that? I mean, if one can be big, why can't, you know, why do they have to diminish the other? Is it just the patriarchy stuff again?
It didn't. I write in Missing Mary quite a few reasons why things converge to make that big overthrow of Mary in 1962 and on, 1962 through 1965, and then after that. But it was the post-war period, and it was very much kind of a macho burst of modernity and rational thought, everything getting just very efficient and rational in every institution. And also in academia, Freudian thought was very strong then in the 50s. And so the young priests coming out of the European universities, I think, were suddenly embarrassed to have this giant mother goddess in the middle of their religion.
Mm-hmm.
So there are about five different reasons that were flowing together to just say, you know, we have to get more rational and cut out all this stuff. And, you know, she was a historical village girl, and that's that, period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's the path they took. It was a very close vote. Oh, very close.
Well, and wasn't there, and forgive me, because I really didn't follow all of this, because I never really connected with my Catholicism, you know, that I grew up with and was born into and didn't really choose. Didn't Pope John Paul, wasn't he going to elevate Mary and while he was Pope, but
no,
then
the
he changed his mind?
It was the opposite.
The opposite.
He was getting petitions to make another dogmatic definition, as they call it, of her attributes. This time it would have been co-redeemer in a special way along with Jesus. But he definitely wanted to go in a modern direction. He was a wonderful pope for peace and all kinds of things, but he was in the group that felt it was time to really play down Mary and play up more rational, modern versions of what Catholicism could be.
Oh, well, you see, I'm confused. I thought because he, you know, he thought those apparitions, you know, when he was saved from the assassin and all of that, I thought he looked
John
at her
Paul
differently.
Oh, John Paul II, I thought you meant, I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about Vatican II, Pope John the 23rd. No, Pope John Paul II was hugely Marian. He's the last pope you're ever going to see who was that much into Mary. You know, of course, he came out of the Polish culture and really carried with him this deep, older kind of communion with Mary, but you won't ever see that again up at the top. He even had a big M put in his papal seal, much to the distress of his staff.
Oh, for Mary. Well, but you think that the big Mary might make a comeback, though?
Well, in certain ways, she is. I mean, the people who were very much against her are having to soften. For instance, feminist progressive academics now say, well, it's okay that the statues are starting to come back into the parish churches because this is the way the people do it. So on the grounds of honoring the people, which is kind of the right deed for the wrong reason, I mean, you know, there are other reasons to understand what this is going on when people do want those statues around instead of just kind of being patronizing about it. But there were a lot of pieces of evidence when I was writing the book, but after the book went into publication, when I was invited to speak at some places, I learned that there's kind of a generational split in the seminaries and other places, and also in communities of nuns and in some of the orders of the priests, in that the older generation who grew up with Mary really feel something went wrong when they threw her out the window so radically at Vatican II. And the middle generation can't stand to hear her talked about. They don't think she's been offed enough.
Oh, okay.
They think she should be reduced even more so we get more rational and get that old mumbo-jumbo out of there.
Hmm.
And then the young ones feel maybe they've missed something growing up without her. you know, they read about the old spiritual practices and the music and all the art, and they wonder, as I say, if they've sort of been cheated out of something. And so they start asking about, well, what was the Marian spirituality? And they want to learn the rosary and things. So it's very interesting. Because before I learned that, it looked like basically the middle range people were just waiting for the old fogies like myself to die off, and then they don't have to talk about Big Mary anymore, you know. But now the younger people are changing that.
Well, now you also say that this comeback of Big Mary has something to do with the correction of the sterility of, you know, of our modern world. Did you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I just see the capitulation of the church to modernize. You know, you have to be really careful if you want to modernize an institution that you don't get sucked into some of the damaging assumptions of modernity. That nothing has any value that you can't measure.
You know, that
it's just the rational, the text-based. I mean, if you're going to go there whole hog, you're going to throw a lot of precious things out the window. So I feel that this recovery of the subtle dimension, the spiritual, the mystical, cosmological dimensions of Mary's presence, it's situated within this larger correction of modernity where all kinds of things are going on that challenge that very machine-like, mechanistic view of the world, efficiency, rational, so-called somebody's idea of the rational at all costs. And it's really being challenged from lots of directions. So I see this as one of the corrections bringing us out of that mechanistic worldview into a more whole, rich, complex, healthy worldview.
Well, and I'm not sure where this fits into all of it, but just as a practitioner out there, you know, from anecdotal observation or whatever you would call it, it seems like Mary is, and Mary Magdalene both, sort of provide a bridge, I think, between progressive Christians and maybe even pagans. I mean, I know I see it in our community here in Los Angeles. Is that an anomaly, or do you see that happening other places too?
Well, she is a bridge figure. I'm glad you said that, because she's a bridge figure between religions. You know, there are a large numbers of Islamic people who go to Marian shrines every year in the Near East, and also Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really the common ground among the three branches of Christianity, if they would see it that way. Instead, they tend to see it as the deal breaker. You know, well, we could unite the church except for this Mary thing, you know.
when it's really all of the gods who are fighting it out for dominance, it's the Mary that's the deal breaker.
Exactly. Blame it on the woman.
Of course. Thank you. I'm glad you said that. Well, Charlene, this has been fun, and I want to make sure if there was anything important that you wanted to leave listeners with that we haven't talked about, you know, I give you a chance to share it, and also, of course, also mention your website if they'd like more information about your books and what you're up to these days.
Oh, sure. Well, I have a website, charlenespretnak.com, about my books, and there's a link in there to the website about missingmary.com, which is specifically about this book we've been talking about, Missing Mary. I guess the last thing I would say, maybe to bring it back to where we started with Our Lady of Guadalupe, is that Pope John Paul II declared her the patron saint of all North America. And she is the visitation. She's the form that Mary took on this land. Of course, it wasn't specifically this land where I'm sitting. It was Mexico City. So I think people have to be sensitive to the fact that some Mexicans and Mexican Americans don't like to see her appropriated by a lot of people all over the place, and other ones are very proud and happy that her presence is influencing all of North America. So I think it's important to just listen and see how, you know, the people you're talking to feel about it, because both views are completely understandable.
Well, that's good to know, because I doubt that everyone is aware of that, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Charlene, thank you for being a guest on the show and especially for participating in the Four Mother series. You know, we're building an incredible archive here, and I really appreciate, as I'm sure my listeners do, you lending your voice and, you know, having it there, you know, indefinitely for people to be able to, you know, look back on and learn from you. So thank you so very much for taking your time tonight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, if you'd like to stay on the line, you're certainly welcome to hear the rest of the show. So, you know, that's up to you. And I'm gonna mute you though, okay? But thank you so very much, and I really do appreciate you know, what you've contributed tonight, and I'm sure my listeners will too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Bye bye.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. Well, listeners, it's time for our What's the Buzz segment, which we've moved to the bottom of the hour when I discuss the bees buzzing around in my bonnet related to what's happening out there in the world, whether it's about spirituality, goddess advocates, or issues related to women, girls, and ideas of the sacred feminine. The first thing I'd like to share with you was a great article in the New York Times, and it was by Nicholas Wade, and it was called The Evolution of the God Gene, and I'm just going to share some of it with you, and then if you want to read more, you can go to the New York Times and put a search in for the title, Evolution of the God Gene, or the writer, Nicholas Wade. He talks about during the 15 years of excavation, they uncovered not monumental temples, but evidence of critical transition in religious behavior. He says the record begins with a simple dancing floor, the arena for the communal religious dancers held by hunter-gatherers in about 7,000 BC, and it moves to the ancestor cult shrines that appeared after the beginning of corn-based agriculture around 1500 BC and ends in AD 30 with the sophisticated astronomically oriented temples of an early archaic state. This and other research points to a new perspective on religion, one that seeks to explain why religious behavior has occurred in societies at every stage of development and in every region of the world. Religion has the hallmarks of an evolved behavior, meaning that it exists because it was favored by natural selection. It's universal because it was wired into our neural circuitry before the ancestral human population dispersed from its African homeland. Well, atheists, they would probably say it's not a particularly welcome thought that religion evolved because it was conferred essential benefits on early human societies and their successors. If religion is a life belt, it's hard to portray it as useless. And for believers, it may seem threatening to think that the mind has been shaped to believe in gods, since the actual existence of the divine may then seem less likely. But the evolutionary perspective on religion does not necessarily threaten the central position of either the atheists or the believers. That religious behavior was favored by natural selection neither proves or disproves the existence of God. He says, for believers, if one accepts that evolution has shaped the human body, then why not the mind? What evolution has done is to endow people with a genetic predisposition to learn the religion of their community, just as they are predisposed to learn its language. With both religion and language, it's culture, not genetics. Then that supplies the content of what's learned. It's easier to see from hunter-gatherer societies how religion may have conferred compelling advantages in the struggle for survival. Their rituals emphasize not theology, but intense communal dancing that may last through the night, the sustained rhythmic movement induced strong feelings of exaltation and emotional commitment to the group. Rituals also solved quarrels between people and patched up their social fabric. The ancestral human population of 50,000 years ago, to judge from living hunter-gatherers, would have lived in small egalitarian groups without chiefs or headmen. Religion served them as an invisible government. It bound people together, committing them to put their community's needs ahead of their own self-interests. For fear of divine punishment, people followed rules of self-restraint toward members of the community. Religion also emboldened them to give their lives in battle against outsiders. Groups fortified by religious belief would have prevailed over those who lacked religious belief, and genes that prompted the mind toward ritual would eventually have become universal. In natural selection, it is genes that enable their owners to leave more surviving progeny that become more common. The idea that natural selection can favor groups instead of acting directly on individuals is highly controversial. Though Darwin proposed the idea, the traditional view among biologists is that selection on individuals would stamp out altruistic behavior because the altruists who spent time helping others would leave fewer children of their own for faster than group-level selection could favor it. But group selection has recently gained two powerful champions, biologists David Sloan Wilson and Edward O. Wilson. They both argue that two special circumstances in recent human evolution would have given group selection much more of an edge than usual. One's the highly egalitarian nature of hunter-gatherer societies, which makes everyone behave alike and gives individual altruists a better chance of passing on their genes. The other is intense warfare between groups, which enhances group-level selection in favor of community-benefiting behavior such as altruism and religion. A propensity to learn the religion of one's community became so firmly implanted in the human neural circuitry, according to this new view, that religion was retained when hunter-gatherers, starting from 15,000 years ago, began to settle in fixed communities. And the larger hierarchical societies made possible by settled living, rulers co-opted religion as their source of authority. Roman emperors made themselves chief priest or even a living god, though most had to had the taste to wait until after death for their deification. Religion was also harnessed to vital practical tasks such as agriculture, which in the first societies to practice this agriculture required unaccustomed forms of labor and organization. Many religions bear traces of the spring and autumn festivals that help get crops planted and harvested at the right time. We can't forget Passover once marked the beginning of the barley festival. Easter, linked to the date of Passover, is a spring festival. So in conclusion, could the evolutionary perspective on religion become the basis for some sort of detente between religion and science? Biologists and many atheists have a lot of respect for evolution and its workings, and if they regarded religious behavior as an evolved instinct, they might see religion more favorably or at least recognize its constructive roles. Religion is often blamed for its spectacular excesses, whether in promoting persecution or warfare, but gets less credit for its staple function of patching up the moral fabric of society. But perhaps it doesn't deserve either blame or credit, the author says. If religion is seen as a means of generating social cohesion, it is a society and its leaders that put the cohesion to good or bad ends. Well, that's the end of the article, and somehow that makes me think about those bumper stickers about guns. Guns and religion, it's sort of like, guns aren't bad unless they're in the hands of bad people. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Some additional food for thought I'd like to share with you first on what some folks are saying about the fourth waves of feminism. This comes from a blog I like called The Uncommon Scold on Newsvine.com, and I thank Loretta Kemsley. She keeps me informed about all of these things. The fourth waves of feminism says there's something to the idea that there's a new model for feminism being built online. For better or worse, the internet has changed feminist organizing, writing, and networking forever. Women no longer have to seek out feminist communities in their towns, which is an impossible task for some. One younger woman I met at a conference told me she was literally the only feminist in her town that she knew. Now feminists can find support and community online. Real-life activism is being organized through email, Facebook, and Twitter, and the ability to have a strong presence in the feminist movement has been somewhat democratized as well. It used to be if you wanted power in the feminism, you had to live in D.C. or New York and be tapped into the established feminist elite. Now all you need, at least to start, is an internet connection. And just a little bit here on feminism and the freedom from the prison of gender roles from that same blog, The Uncommon Scold, Newsvine.com. So what went wrong? Feminism and the freedom from the prison of gender roles. Author contends that most of the unnecessary suffering in human life, the suffering due to clinging, aggression, bewilderment, to birth, aging, sickness, and death, is due to the prison of gender roles, which is why freedom from that prison, not new, reformed gender roles, is what we actually need. Clearly, the writer says she proposes the definition of feminism is gender neutral and pertains to men as much as it does to women, but that vision has not been pursued in the same way by men as it has by women. Therefore, since liberation for all has not been achieved, liberation is quite limited. It's time to renew or perhaps start a real dialogue about the prison of gender roles in which we discuss the reality that both the male and female gender roles are imprisoning, and ask what we can do to free ourselves as a culture from an obsolete and dysfunctional definition of the male gender role that's become dangerous to human survival, even it as it has become more entrenched as a cultural ideal for both men and women. And there's a comment on here I'd like to share because I believe it's very well thought out. And Mo Cowgirl, that's her name. She says, But both men and women will be more tolerant of aggression and competitiveness in a culture that values these traits over gentleness and friendliness, and both women and men will pursue them. The hardwiring argument is often a handy excuse for not doing the psychological and spiritual hard work that genuine growth and change require, especially if that growth contradicts socialization and cultural values. But it should not take too much thought to realize that gladiator-type violence is not conducive to a peaceful, nonviolent society. I find it difficult to believe that young men are condemned to relish such violence by virtue of their Y chromosome, rather than by virtue of a culture that tolerates violence and rewards competitiveness. I think this sums up American society quite well. And let me just move on here to the next item. This is about abortion and the healthcare debate. Well, if you haven't been watching the news, probably the last 24 hours, there is good news. The Senate voted on the anti-choice Nelson Hatch amendment to the healthcare reform bill, and we won. Unlike the Stupak amendment that passed the House of Representatives, this amendment did not pass the Senate. As you know, Democratic Senator Ben Nelson and Republican Senator Orrin Hatch were behind the anti-choice amendment, and the language was virtually identical to the Stupak amendment. As we saw during the vote in the House of Representatives, anti-choice groups were lobbying hard to pass it, but the Senate agreed with us this time, eliminating choice for millions of women with private health insurance is a price we can't afford to pay for passing health reform. Well, what really felt good was seeing our California Congresswoman calling the men out, asking them how they'd feel needing a separate insurance rider for Viagra or other male-only oriented care. So thanks to our senators who stood up for women, for choice, and for health care. Also, in the news, in case you haven't heard, the pagans were part of the Parliament of World Religion in Australia, and actually today is the last day. But pagans from a variety of countries and traditions were among those who have gathered in Melbourne, Australia, for the 2009 Parliament of World Religions. It's one of the world's oldest and largest international interfaith gatherings. Leaders and practitioners of a wide range of religions and spiritual traditions from 80 countries around the world participate, and organizers expected up to about 8,000 participants. And in the closing ceremonies today, the Dalai Lama actually spoke. Pagans were among the presenters at the parliament. You can view the list of pagan ceremonies and panels, plus presentations that pagans offered at the circlesanctuary.org website. At previous parliaments, Circle Sanctuary was among the religious organizations supporting the parliament, and they were there again this year. Circle Sanctuary community members and ministers at the 2009 parliament included Reverend Patrick McCullum of California, who report back here on the show the Wednesday before Christmas or Yule, and there were other folks from Circle Sanctuary there as well. And including Reverend Angie Buchanan, who is the director of Gaia's Womb Earth Traditions. She's actually an executive board member for the council, and she's going to be doing a review of the parliament on my examiner.com column. I've asked her to be a contributing writer and let us know from her perspective what actually happened there. All right. Well, if you're wondering why I consistently have this segment, What's the Buzz, with each show, well, it's because the programming out there has been so pervasive. The fear mongers and intolerance seem to have ratcheted up their dogma, so we have to constantly educate, whether we're educating about women's issues or religion or human issues. There's just so much disinformation and intentional deflection going on. I think we have to inoculate ourselves against ignorance, intolerance, and all those insidious isms. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. Well, we are well into our Four Mothers and Way Showers series, and I thank you for your interest. You see, hosts of shows can see how many people are listening, and you're definitely out there tuning in. So I really do thank you for your listener loyalty. And don't forget, this series was inspired by you, and I just followed through on the brainstorm you gave me to put this series together. It was you who asked, where are Rhianne Eisler, Carol Chris, Genevieve Vaughn, Charlene Spretnak, Barbara Walker? Well, they're here every week, usually on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific, and they're still generously giving more of their time for you to hear what's stoking their passion these days. So to keep you updated, some of the more recent folks we've just booked on the show, or as I just mentioned, Patrick McCullum will be a guest in a couple weeks, as will be Razit Ergener, Daniel Cohen, and Heidi Gottner-Abendroth, who edited the new book, Societies of Peace, Matriarchies, Past, Present, and Future, which everyone's talking about. All three of those folks are from across the pond, as we say, or from the European continent. Christina Biaggi has been booked, as is Michael York, who just presented at the American Academy of Religion and the Parliament of World Religions, where his topic was Men Who Love the Goddess. So if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk, we can take your caller questions usually. So if you like, you know, on most shows, just remember you can dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview or during my What's the Buzz segment at 718-766-4662 if you want to jot that down someplace. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll usually just identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to chat with me or our guest. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. People do that all the time. Or they send me articles, too, they'd like me to share with listeners. But keep tuning in each Wednesday night at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener at no charge and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guest lineup each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, you heard me mention before, I'm the LA Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner for examiner.com, so I invite you to please check out my articles. You can find them easily by either going to examiner.com and put my name in the search box, or go to my website, KarenTate.com, and on the home page up at the top, there's a link there where you can go to the column. Well, I guess people like Starhawk and Jean Shinoda Bolin and Rhianne Eisler, some of these foremothers who were my elders and mentors, I'm trying to follow in their footsteps and be out there in the world, invisible, trying to activate minds about the ideals of the sacred feminine that address cultural issues, women's issues, and the politics of spirituality, whether it be healthcare or sexism. Or the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people. Please don't forget, our Cakes for the Queen of Heaven series starts at the Goddess Temple in Orange County in January. They've asked me to teach those 11 classes. There's two each month. You don't have to sign up for the entire series. You can take individual classes. There will be two a month, and it'll run through July, and we're going to take April off and take a break to rethink and reclaim and just sort of take in everything we're learning. If you want more information, you can contact me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. If you want to hear a talk I'll be giving soon, I'll be giving one on sacred places of goddess around the world in January at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olindor, the home of Carla and Leigh McCloskey. So if you want more information about that, don't hesitate to email. And I invite you to visit the media page of my website and catch the radio interviews I'm invited to do. There's lots of great interviews there on the media page. Pretty soon I'm going to be interviewed by a station in South Africa, and I'm talking about the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And if you didn't know, there are free downloadable meditations on the website. You just go to the Goddess Store and scroll down past my books, and you can just click on those, and they're absolutely free. While you're there, check out my two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which has garnered prestigious endorsements, and Walking in Ancient Paths, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, which won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. The scholar David Hillman has remarked that the book, Walking in Ancient Paths, is an immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. And I kind of like that. I'm proud of it. My events page is there. See if I'll be appearing in a town near you. See what folks, what talks I have available to give your group. And yes, some people have asked me if I travel outside of LA. I do if I have a group sponsor. There's lots of free articles and links there referring you to people around the world making a difference. So please take some time and check out these folks who are really dedicated. And take advantage of the offer I have on my website in the Goddess Store. You can get both my books for $25 plus shipping and handling, and that's actually a better deal than Amazon. So in closing, I'd like to leave you with the guest lineup for December on Four Mothers and Wayshower series here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Next week, we have Rhianne Eisler on the show. Now, Rhianne has just recently received the 2009 Distinguished Peace Leadership Award. You can read her acceptance speech at RhianneEisler.com. Also, she recently addressed the United Nations. I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit about that as well as all of her other work. Then on the 23rd, the Wednesday before Christmas or Yule, we're going to have Eleanor Gadden and Patrick McCullum. And then on December 30th, we're going to have Isaac Bonowitz. So to say goodnight for another week, I'm going to leave you with a beautiful musical piece by Lane Redman. She's one of the newest artists that have lent her music to me to be played here on the show. And I think I'm going to go ahead and choose the one called Invoking Aphrodite. So I'd just like to say goodnight and thank you for tuning in. I'd like to thank our guest again, Charlene Spretnak, for her time and her wisdom and her insight. Hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Don't forget to email in your questions, and I always love to hear your feedback. It's like gas in my tank, seriously. So here is Lane Redman's music called Invoking Aphrodite.
Sacred grove. Your altars are smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze. And a breathe. Come, Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your Melissa to life.
Sacred grove.
Your altars are smoking with incense. Cold water seems